She looked down the corridor at the small side door ahead of her. Just a few more steps, she thought, and she kept walking. Three more steps.
Slowly walking.
Two more steps.
Finally, she slipped out the door in one quick movement and went out into the cold darkness of the night.
Mr. Thorne followed her outside, pulling his billowing black cloak and hood up around his head and shoulders as he entered the night. As the snow fell gently down from the moonlit sky, she ran across the grass and ducked into the brambles. The maze of twisting paths was a bewildering convolution of bushes and hedges, with dark shadows, blind corners, and dead ends. A place where the man in the black cloak had killed before. But she knew this place, too. She knew it better than anyone. She moved swiftly through the maze. She imagined she'd see the ghost of Anastasia Rostanova searching the paths for her little white dog.
The man in the black cloak followed her down one pathway after another.
"Why are you running away from me, child?"
he asked in a hideous, raspy voice. Too frightened to answer, she just kept moving. When she looked over her shoulder to see how much of a lead she'd gained, she saw him coming up behind her. In the long, flowing black cloak, he flew a foot off the ground, standing erect, his arms stretched out like a wraith, his huge, blood-stained hands reaching to grab her. Her breath caught in her throat so severely that she couldn't even scream. Terrified, she sprinted forward with a burst of speed. To stop was to die, and it was far too early to die. Seeing a hole in the bushes, she dove through it. She left the manicured paths of the brambles behind her and ran into the wild forest. Tearing through the underbrush, she made quick time. She ducked behind trees. She scurried into and through thickets. She delved into the deepest shadows of the forest. She ran and ran and ran, deep into the darkest night, her nemesis close on her tail. The thickness of the forest made it difficult for her pursuer. The trees grew so close together that an adult could barely squeeze between them. The spiny thickets were so bristling with thorns that they were nearly impenetrable. But with her smaller size and her agility, she could move easily, darting betwixt and between, scrambling below and leaping above. She moved as swift as a weasel through the brush. The forest was her ally. She was terrified that he'd catch her and kill her, but she didn't want to lose him completely either. When he fell behind or lost her trail in the snow, she slowed down to let him catch up. Deep into the woods she led him. She had studied the way and formed a map in her mind, but even with the shortcut she planned to take, they still had miles to go. As she ran, she kept thinking about Braden, her pa, and the Vanderbilts. She kept thinking about what had happened to Clara, Anastasia, and Nolan. She had to defeat Mr. Thorne. She had to kill him. Her only chance lay ahead of her. She was out of breath and desperately tired. Her legs ached, and her lungs felt like she was breathing through steel wool. She wasn't sure how much farther she could run. But then, she finally saw what she'd been running for. Gravestones. There were hundreds of them standing in the silver light of the moon beneath the bare branches of the gnarled old winter trees. This was the place that terrified her, but she knew she must come. She ran through the old cemetery. An eerie fog was rising among the twisted branches of the ancient trees and the decaying monuments of the dead. She looked behind her. The man in the black cloak flew toward her out of the mist, his bloody hands reaching for her. Serafina ran with all her heart. She dashed past Cloven Smith, the murdered man. She leapt over the two sisters lying side by side.
she raced through the 66 Confederate soldiers. She arrived, finally, panting and exhausted, at the small glade with the statue of the winged angel. Serafina could hear the man in the black cloak crashing through the brush behind her. She had only seconds before he arrived. Fear flooded through her veins. She became sickeningly aware that she was bringing two great forces together, and she was between them. From one direction or another, there was a good chance that death would soon be upon her. She ran to the edge of the moonlit glade where the old willow lay with its upturned roots. The thick trunk and heavy branches of the fallen master of the forest swirled with ghostly mist. Its delicate leaves, somehow still growing bright green in the winter, glistened with the starlight. Praying that the great yellow-eyed prowler of the night was out hunting, Serafina found the hole in the ground beneath the roots. She dropped down onto her hands and knees and crawled into the mountain lion's den. She came face to face with the two spotted cubs, who stared at her with large, frightened eyes as she moved toward them. "Where's your mama?" she asked them. When the cubs saw that it was her, they jumped up in relief. They moved toward her, smelling her and rubbing themselves on her body. She crawled past the two cubs and curled into a little ball in the earthen den. Now the trap was laid. Just as she had done when she crawled inside the machine in Biltmore's basement, she made herself very still and very quiet. She steadied her lungs and her heart. She shut her eyes and concentrated, extending her senses outward into the forest. "I know you're out there someplace, hunting your domain. Where are you? Your cubs are in danger." Serafina could feel it. Out there in the darkness of the woods beyond the graveyard, the mother lion paused in her hunting. She tilted her head at the sound of two intruders in the forest. Her forest. Her cubs were in danger. She turned and charged back toward her den with all her speed. The man in the black cloak came into the angel's glade and looked around him.
"Where have you led me, dear child?"
he said, trying to figure out which direction Serafina had gone. He circled the stone pedestal of the moss-covered angel.
"Do you think you can hide from me, little rabbit?"
he asked.
"I'm not a rabbit," Serafina thought fiercely.
For a brief moment, she felt a sensation of triumph, because it seemed like her plan was going to work. The man in the black cloak would be left standing haplessly in the angel's glade. He would have no idea where she'd gone. She had disappeared. She had escaped him. But then she remembered the snow. She had not accounted for the snow. Her tracks led straight to her hiding place. The tracks would betray her. The man in the black cloak said when he saw the tracks.
"There you are."
He walked over to the den, got down on his hands and knees, and looked inside.
"I know you're in there. Come on out, my dear child, before I become angry with you."
Serafina tried not to breathe. The man in the black cloak reached deep inside the den, his bloody hand searching in the darkness. She could smell his horrible, rotting stench. The folds of his slithering cloak twisted and turned as it snaked its way through the opening, rattling in anticipation of the coming meal. Holding the cubs against her chest in terror, Serafina pulled back as far as she could go. She knew that if that man's hand or the folds of his cloak grabbed her, He'd drag her out of the den, and her life would end in the most hideous way.
"I'm not going to hurt you, child,"
he rasped as he reached for her. At that moment, all the power and ferocity of clawed motherhood came ripping out of the woods. Enraged by the intruder at the mouth of her den, the lioness pounced upon his back. The terrific momentum of her attack rolled him to the ground. She struck her front claws into his back and chest, even as she sunk her teeth into his neck and head. The man in the black cloak shouted out in a shock of pain. He fought hard to defend himself from the powerful cat. He drew his dagger, but the lioness slashed his hand. Hissing and growling in fury, the lioness bit and clawed him repeatedly, mercilessly. The man in the black cloak punched and kicked and tried to get to his feet. But the furious lioness was too fast and too strong. He didn't have time to find the fallen dagger. He tried to slam her with a large branch, but she swatted him so hard with her razor-clawed paw that it ripped open his flesh and knocked him to the ground. Then she lunged at him and bit down on his neck, forcing him to the ground with her weight the way she would kill a deer. She held her powerful jaws clenched on his throat until he slowly stopped struggling and finally became still. The man in the black cloak went limp. The lioness dropped him into a bloody black heap like the carcass of a dead animal. The trap had sprung. A rush of joy and relief poured through Serafina. Her plan had worked. She'd finally defeated the man in the black cloak. She'd done it. She'd saved Brayden. She'd saved Biltmore. She'd really done it. Her skin tingled with excitement. She wished she could somehow magically communicate with Brayden from a distance and tell him what had happened. It almost felt like she could turn herself into a bird and fly away. She'd fly up into the sky like a whippoorwill and do loop-de-loops in the clouds until she was too dizzy to fly anymore. Ecstatic, she began to crawl toward the entrance of the den so that she could run home. But it was too late. Death was upon her. The lioness, still fiercely angry, entered the den to kill the second intruder. Her. Chapter 22. There was only one way in and out of the den, and the lioness was going to tear Serafina to shreds. The lioness would kill her the same way she had killed the first intruder. To the lioness, there was no difference between them. With a surge of panic, Serafina scrambled to the back of the den, trying desperately to get out of the lioness's reach. She sucked air in and out of her lungs. Her legs were kicking and thrashing like the hooves of a panicked horse. But she had no place to go. The lioness came straight in. Her muscles bulged and rolled beneath her tan coat. Her eyes blazed. She held her mouth partly open. Her massive, sharp teeth gleamed. Her breaths froze in the frosty air as her sides heaved in and out. Steam rose off her body. As she pushed her way in towards Serafina, the lioness growled a low and menacing growl, fiercely determined to kill the creature that had invaded her den. Serafina cowered behind the cubs with her back against the earthen wall. She tried to brace herself, to stay strong, but she shook uncontrollably. Unable to escape, she pulled her legs up against her chest, ready to defend herself, ready to kick. She tightened her hands to scratch and claw. She snapped her teeth and snarled. Just as the lioness was about to lunge toward her and snap her neck, Serafina looked straight into the lioness's face and screamed as loudly and violently as she could, her teeth bared and threatening like a cornered bobcat. She wanted to let this lion know that she might be small, but she wasn't going to die easy. Undeterred by Serafina's defense, the mountain lion stared her down with huge, penetrating yellow eyes. Serafina gasped. The cat's eyes were the exact same color as her own. She looked into the cat's face. And then, in the next second, she saw what appeared to be a flicker of recognition in the lioness's eyes. The lioness hesitated, stopping just a few inches in front of her. She could see in the animal's expression that the lioness was thinking the same thing she was. Their eyes were the same. They weren't predator and prey. They weren't protector and intruder. They were connected. She looked into the lioness's eyes, and the lioness looked into hers. There were no words between them. There could not be. But in that moment, there was understanding. There was a bond between them. They were the same. They were hunters. They were prowlers of the night. But even more than all that, they were kin. Chapter 23. With her back crammed up against the rear wall of the den and her knees pulled up to her chest, Serafina stared at the mountain lion in amazement. Her heart pounded. Her body was folded up so tightly that she could only take short, shallow breaths. The lioness gazed at her with the most mesmerizing amber-gold eyes she had ever seen. How was it possible that they looked just like hers? Images and ideas flashed through her mind in a swirling confusion, but none of it made sense. The lioness took another step toward her. Serafina remained perfectly still, trying to breathe as steady as she could. She made no sudden movements. She saw an intelligence and awareness in the lioness's eyes. They were filled with a gentleness and understanding far beyond that of a wild animal. She knew she could not speak to the lioness in words, but she yearned to. The lioness pushed her nose against Serafina's shoulder and smelled her. The lioness's breath was loud in her ears, her lungs sounding like a bellows, the air rushing in and out. The moisture around the lioness's partially opened mouth glistened, and her teeth shone. Her deep scent was both foreign and familiar to Serafina. She'd never smelled a lion in her life, but it smelled exactly the way she expected it would. As she looked at the lioness, she wished more than anything in the world that she could somehow communicate with her. She felt a deep longing to know what she was thinking and feeling in that moment. Serafina exhaled gently and then took in a breath and held it as she slowly raised her trembling hand and touched the side of the lioness's head. She caressed the lioness's fur. The lioness stared at her, her eyes locked on her. But the lioness did not move. She did not growl or bite. And Serafina began to breathe again. She stroked the side of the lioness's head and then down her neck. The lioness rubbed her shoulder against Serafina's body, and Serafina felt the power and weight of the animal against her, so much weight that it prevented her from breathing for several seconds and she almost panicked. But then the lioness moved again and she could breathe once more. When Serafina relaxed her folded knees, the lioness put her head against Serafina's chest. Serafina touched the back of her neck and her ears. Then the lioness slowly leaned down and lay down beside her, with her cubs around her, and swished her long tail. Serafina held the fuzzy little mewing cubs in her arms and hugged them. She felt her chest swelling and her limbs tingling. She was filled with pride and happiness. The little lions were welcoming her. They loved her. And for a moment, she was swept up with the feeling that she had finally come home. She thought about how she was different from other people. The seeing in the dark, the moving quietly, the hunting at night. She looked at the palm of her hand and opened her fingers and then examined her fingertips one by one. Were they fingernails or were they claws? What was her connection to the lioness? Why did she feel like she belonged here? But the more she thought about it, the more ludicrous it became in her mind. She was a person. She was wearing clothes. She lived in a house full of human beings. And that's where she wanted to be. She had to get back to Braden and her paw and the world she knew, the world she loved. Clenching her teeth and shaking her head, she crawled out of the lioness's den. She stumbled into the open glade and stood beneath the stars in utter confusion. She looked over at where the battle had taken place. The black cloak lay in a heap on the ground. Thorn's bloody body lay beside it. His other clothing had been shredded by the lioness's claws. Blood stained his white shirt. A large open wound bled at his side. His head and face were badly bitten and clawed. She could see his blood glistening, and she knew from watching rats die that glistening blood meant he wasn't completely dead yet. But he soon would be. Sometimes you killed a dying rat, but other times you just let it die. Standing in the angel's glade, she looked up at the sky and the trees and all around her. She had won. She had defeated the man in the black cloak. It felt like every muscle in her body was alive and moving. There was a part of her that felt elated, almost euphoric, like she was floating on air. But another part of her was deeply confused. She had solved one mystery, only to be confronted with another. Why did she feel this way inside? And why hadn't the lioness attacked her? "What does it all mean?" she asked aloud in frustration. She took a few steps, kicking her feet roughly through the snow. She was so sick of not knowing anything, not having the answers. "Tell me what it all means," she shouted to the heavens.
"Put me on," came a raspy voice.
Chapter 24. Serafina looked around her.
"Put me on."
She felt the words in their ancient raspy voice more than she heard them, and she knew exactly where they were coming from. She looked at the black cloak, lying there on the ground beside Thorn's body. The cloak lay crumpled in the snow by itself, torn from him by the force of the attack.
"Imagine knowing all things."
"Shut up," she told the cloak, her words spitting out of her like she was reprimanding an uppity rat she'd captured.
"Imagine being able to do anything you wanted to do."
She gritted her teeth and snarled at it. "You're dead. Now hush up."
"There's nothing to fear."
Serafina felt the trembling agitation of pure fear growing deep within her. Every muscle in her body was telling her to flee, but she was too angry to go. She clenched her teeth. She wanted to fight. She wanted to win.
"Put me on,"
the raspy voice came again. She looked at the cloak. It was the cloak of power, the cloak of knowing. She felt an overwhelming desire to touch it. She wanted to hold it in her hands. She could feel it using its power to draw her in, and she didn't care. She wanted the power.
Imagine understanding and controlling everything around you.
She took a step toward the cloak.
Put me on.
She reached down and picked up the black cloak. The satin material reflected the sheen of the moonlight as she turned it over in her hands. Despite the running through the thickets, the flying through the forest, and the battle with the mountain lion, the cloak wasn't torn or dirtied in any way. She examined the cloak carefully, looking for any sign or symbol of the power that it contained. As she moved the material through her hands, it didn't feel like a normal piece of clothing, but like a living, pulsing thing, like holding a giant snake.
Put me on,
the cloak said again in its low, raspy voice. She looked at the cloak's silver clasp, which was engraved with an intricate design, a tight bundle of twisting vines and thorns. When she held the clasp in the moonlight in just the right way, she could see the image of tiny faces behind the thorns. She didn't know what it meant. It felt like she didn't know what anything meant anymore. A black and terrible loneliness welled up inside her, an anguish stronger than anything she had ever felt before. But what did the cloak do? How did it work? Did it really give its master the blessing of profound knowledge? Could it answer the questions that stormed through her mind?
You will become all-knowing, all-powerful,
the cloak whispered. Her head spun in confusion. Cloudiness closed in on her mind. She was unable to control herself. Her fingers grasped, her arms moved, and she began pulling the cloak around her. Drawn in by its powerful spell, she draped the black cloak over her back and shoulders, just for a brief moment to see what would happen. She only wanted to wear it for a few seconds, just long enough to see how it felt. As she pulled on the cloak, it spoke to her once more.
Welcome, Seraphina. I am not going to hurt you, child.
Chapter 25. As soon as Seraphina put the cloak on, her world changed. The weight of the cloak on her shoulders felt strangely satisfying. The cloak gave off no stench or foul smell. There was no blood or fear while she was wearing the cloak. It made no rattling sound. Everything about it felt fine and good. She used her fingers to clasp the cloak at her throat. Although it had been a full-length cloak on the much taller Mr. Thorne, it fit her body perfectly. She held out her arms and pivoted and looked at the cloak on her body. She thought she looked very sophisticated and aristocratic wearing it. Then she walked a few paces back and forth, testing how it draped and flowed. It felt like she was dancing with every movement she made. "I look good in this," she said. Her voice sounded strong and confident. She didn't feel nearly as confused, tired, and discouraged as she had just a moment before. No, she wasn't tired at all anymore. She felt rested, capable, optimistic. She felt powerful. Wearing the cloak, she felt as if she could do almost anything, solve any puzzle, accomplish any task, play any instrument, speak another language, and if she tried, maybe even fly. It was a wonderful, glorious feeling, and she spun around the angel's glade, kicking up the snow.
"The power is within us,"
the cloak whispered. She tried to imagine it. She'd be famous and popular, and everyone would love her. She'd have many friends and a huge family of people who adored her. She'd travel all over the world. She'd know more than everyone else. No one could defeat her.
"We will work together."
She'd be the most powerful girl in the entire world.
"We will be a great force."
With the fabric of the cloak wrapped around her, she began to understand things about it that she could not before. She could see its history, like a dark dream in her mind. The cloak had been conjured by a sorcerer who had lived in a nearby village. He'd intended to use it to gain talents and understanding, to learn languages and skills, and to become a great unifying leader in society. But his creation went terribly awry. He hadn't just created a concentrator of knowledge. He'd created an enslaver of souls. When he realized what he had done, he tried to hurl the cloak into the village's deepest well. He fought with the cloak, tearing and pulling and throwing. But the cloak grasped at him and twisted around him and would not let go until finally the sorcerer threw himself and the cloak together down the well, thinking that he would destroy them both. As the years passed, the sorcerer's body rotted in the well, putrefied. But the cloak remained, perfect and unharmed, until years later when it was found by the drunken and desperate Mr. Thorne. The cloak had the power to acquire knowledge and capability, to concentrate the talents of 100 people into a single person. She had seen what Mr. Thorne did with that capability. She imagined what she could do with it. She'd be able to do anything she wanted. She could go anywhere. She'd know everything. She'd finally find all the answers. She ran her fingers down the fabric of the cloak and felt its potency coursing through her. It contained such tremendous capability, she thought. She tried to imagine what great things she could do with it, what good and beneficial deeds she could accomplish in the world. It seemed like it would be such a shame to waste that power. Someone had to use the cloak. It might as well be her.
"Lift the hood of the cloak."
She felt good and hopeful and buoyant.
"Put on the hood."
She reached up and gathered the cloak's hood in her fingers and pulled it onto her head. Then she screamed in horror at the shock of what she saw. The edges of her sight blurred into a dark and vibrating tunnel. She could still see the physical world directly in front of her, but the hood pressed in on her peripheral vision with a crush of dead children and adults pushing their faces up against hers. The faces of the dead children surrounded her. A little blonde girl cried as she pressed her cold, dead face against Serafina's, touching her pleadingly with her grasping fingers.
"I can't find my mother. Can you help me?"
"Bazalushcha, skazwicha gdemoy otyets,"
a girl with long, curly black hair said, pressing her face against Serafina's.
"Please help me,"
wailed a woman, only to be pushed out of the way by two more faces. The visages of terrified children and adults were crowded inside the cloak.
"The horses are trapped,"
a boy shouted, pressing his face in among the others.
"Watch out!"
Serafina screamed and ripped the hood from her head. She gazed around the empty glade, shaking and gasping for breath. The souls of the dead people were imprisoned in the black folds of the cloak. This was the cloak's power, to enslave people's talents and hold their souls prisoner in a ghastly cage.
Come, little creature. We shall be together.
She shook her head, trying desperately to resist the cloak's powerful spell.
We shall control the world.
No,
she said, gritting her teeth.
Everyone shall love us.
No,
she shouted.
I won't do it.
She unclasped the cloak from her neck and tore it away. The act of ripping it from her body struck her such a blow that she fell onto her hands and knees, suddenly debilitated by extreme fatigue and despair. But, filled with determination, she got back up onto her feet. She tried to hurl the cloak to the ground, but the slithering creature tangled itself in her arms and wouldn't let go. She couldn't free herself from it.
Alone you are a weak little creature, but together we are strong.
No,
she shouted. She knew that she had to get rid of the cloak. She had to destroy it. As the cloak roiled and twisted like black snakes in her hands, she tried to tear the material in her fingers, but they weren't strong enough to rend it. The cloak, seething and hissing, wrapped around her arms and her legs, clinging to her. A bloody hand reached up from the ground and gripped her ankle. Chapter 26. Seraphina screamed.
Don't hurt the cloak, you stupid child,
Thorn snarled. Wounded and crazed, he yanked her to the ground, knocked the wind out of her, and held her down.
If you destroy it, then we'll lose everything.
She struggled to escape him, but he clenched her by the arms, and she couldn't get free.
We'll work together, he rasped, you with your abilities and me with mine. Don't you see? We're the same. We're on the same side.
Something was happening to him. Thorn's face was gray and deteriorating, his skin flaking off around his cheeks and eyes. His hair had turned gray and wiry, his mouth dripped with blood. A wave of revulsion poured through her. She tried to kick him and bite his hands and pull herself free, but she couldn't wrest herself from his grip. He held her to the ground with all his weight, pushing the air painfully from her lungs. She could feel her ribs bending, starting to crack. Despite his wounds and his decomposing condition, Thorn seemed to be getting stronger and stronger, driven by his greed for the cloak.
I'll never give in to you, she snarled into his face. Never!
Then you're going to die, little mouser.
Pressing her down, he crushed into her. She couldn't breathe. Without air flowing through her lungs, she couldn't move, couldn't think. Even as she fought to get away, she felt her life draining from her, her arms and legs falling limp, her mind clouding with the white light of death. She thought there was supposed to be a sense of peace when death finally came, but she didn't feel it. There was still too much to do in her life, still too many questions to answer, too many mysteries to solve. And it was the mysteries, the unfinished business, the want that kept her going. She didn't want to die, especially not this way. But she could feel herself drifting now, the life ebbing out of her, her soul slipping away. But she kept seeing a vision of her paw in her mind. She could hear his voice.
Eat your grits, girl,
he demanded.
I'm not gonna eat my grits, she shouted back at him.
Her paw gazed at her dying on the ground beneath her enemy's weight, and he shook his head.
The rat don't kill the cat, girl, he said. That just ain't right.
The rat don't kill the cat, she thought, as she pulled her wayward soul back into her body with fierce determination.
The rat don't kill the cat,
she thought again as she felt a burst of new strength. She began to fight anew, pulling her arm free from her captor. At that moment, a large black shape lunged out of the mist with a ferocious snarl and a flash of white teeth. At first, she thought it must be some kind of black wolf. But it wasn't a wolf. It was a dog. A Doberman. It was Gideon. Gideon bit into Thorn's side and pulled him to the ground, then plunged in for another attack, biting and snapping. Thorn grabbed his fallen dagger from the ground and slashed Gideon in the side. Gideon yelped in pain and pulled back. Then the mountain lion charged out of her den and dove into the battle. She attacked Thorn with rapid swats of her clawed paws, her teeth snarling and her ears pressed back against her head, as if she was mightily perturbed that he hadn't stayed dead. Plunging back into the fight, the wounded Gideon chomped Thorn's arm, forcing him to drop the dagger, then tore into his shoulder and dragged him viciously across the ground, shaking him. Seraphina spotted the black cloak lying on the ground. She darted into the battle and snatched up the dagger that had fallen from Thorn's hand. Then she attacked the cloak with the blade. She was sure this was the answer. She cut and stabbed, trying to slice through the material. But the cloak fought against her, twisting and turning and rattling. Becoming a black seething coil in her hands, the cloak clutched at her and wrapped itself around her arms and then her body and began to crush her. No matter how hard she tried, she could not cut the snaking cloth. As the folds of the black cloak slithered around her neck and began to tighten, she tried to scream for help. But the cloak choked her breath short. Nothing but horrible gagging noises escaped from her clasped throat. Gasping for breath and clutching at her neck, she struggled to get up onto her feet. She stumbled toward the statue of the angel in the middle of the glade. It had sliced my finger with the slightest touch. In one swift motion, she hurled herself onto the point of the angel's gleaming sword. The sword slashed the side of her neck with searing pain as its tip pierced into the folds of the black cloak. The cloak screamed and hissed as the razor-sharp edges cut into it. Seraphina grabbed at her neck and tore the cloak away, then clenched the material in her fists and slammed the cloak onto the sword point. She pierced it again and again. The cloak slithered and screeched, coiling like a tortured serpent. It writhed in her hands as she tore the cloth, but she did not relent. When she was finally done, there was nothing left of the black cloak but shreds lying at the angel's feet. Seraphina fell away, panting and exhausted, pressing her hand to the wound at her neck to staunch the bleeding. She looked over and saw Thorn pinned to the ground beneath her allies. Thorn was strong, but without the black cloak, he was no match for the speed, power, and jaws of both Gideon and the lioness. Seraphina felt a wave of triumph pass through her. They'd done it. It was all over. It had to be. But as Gideon and the lioness struck the final killing bites into Thorn, his body emitted a frightening sizzling sound, like meat burning on a fire. His carcass vibrated as his skin burned and peeled down into blood and bones. A thick cloud of smoke emanated from his body as it rapidly disintegrated, as if enkindled by the air itself. Gideon stepped back and tilted his head in confusion. The lioness retreated into the den to protect her cubs. The stinking black effluence poured forth until the roiling smoke filled the entire glade. The whole area became a great choking cloud. Seraphina coughed, waved her arms and tried to escape from the smoke.
"Come on, Gideon,"
she called, and pulled him back as she gagged on the horrible taste of the smoke in her throat. Overwhelmed by the fumes and unable to see, she tripped over something and fell face first to the ground. Whatever she tripped over was hard, like a branch. But when she looked, she realized it wasn't a branch. It was a human leg. She whimpered in horror and scrambled away from it. The body of a little girl lay on the ground, her arms and legs tangled and bent at crooked angles. Chapter 27. Serafina crawled several yards across the angel's glade, then got up onto her feet, her whole body shaking with fear. She looked again at the body of the girl lying on the ground. It had blonde hair and wore a yellow dress. A yellow dress! How was that possible? The body was face down. Serafina couldn't see the face, just the hair, the sickly pale legs, and the crumpled fingers of the hands. Just as she took a small tentative step toward the body to get a closer look, one of the fingers twitched. Serafina leapt back, grabbing Gideon for protection. Gideon barked and snarled at the body, his teeth white and gleaming. The hand bent. Then the body's arm moved, then a leg. It was like a carcass crawling its way out of a grave. Serafina's instinct was to run, but she forced herself to stay. The body slowly got up onto its hands and knees, the hair falling around the face and covering it. Serafina was horrified to think what the face was going to look like, imagining it to be the face of a carcass. Bloody and rotted, the thing stood erect on 2 feet. Serafina watched in a paralyzed state of horror. Gideon lunged and snapped repeatedly, warding off the zombie's attack. But then the head slowly turned, and the hair parted, and Serafina looked into the face. It wasn't a rotting monster, but the perfect features and lucid pale blue eyes of Clara Brahms. Clara opened her mouth and spoke in a desperately sweet voice. "Please, can you help me?" Serafina froze, astounded. Clara was alive. She stood before her in her yellow dress as bright and bold as a Sunday morning. Her body and her soul had been freed. "I remember you," Clara said to Serafina. She reached out and clutched Serafina's hand. Serafina flinched back reflexively, but the hand that grasped her was warm and full of life. "I saw you," Clara said. "I called out to you. I knew you'd help me. I just knew it." Too shocked to speak or respond to Clara in any way, Serafina turned and looked across the glade. As the smoke cleared, it revealed the bodies of many children and adults lying on the ground. The victims of the cloak woke up slowly, as if from a long, nightmarish sleep. Some of them sat on the ground in confusion for a long time. Others stood and looked around them. A tall girl with long curly black hair came up to Serafina and started speaking to her in Russian. She seemed very sweet, but scared and anxious to reunite with her father and her dog. And there was a young man as well, who didn't understand what was happening.
"Have you seen my violin?"
he asked repeatedly.
"I seem to have lost it."
A small boy with a mop of curly brown hair, wearing an oversized coachman's jacket, touched Serafina's arm.
"Pardon me, Miss Serafina, but have you seen the young master? I've got to get home. My father is going to be worried about me, and the horses need to be fed their grain. Do you know the way to Biltmore?
Nolan, it's you. You're alive.
Serafina grabbed the little boy and hugged him.
I'm so glad to see you. Don't worry, I'll take you home.
You're bleeding, miss,
he said, gesturing toward her neck. She touched the wound. It hurt a bit, but the bleeding had stopped.
I'm all right, she said.
The truth was, she'd suffered multiple cuts and bruises, but she didn't care about that. She was just so happy to be alive. She looked at all the children, took a long, deep breath, and smiled. She felt a tremendous sense of relief, a sense of exaltation. They were alive. They were safe. She had saved them. Then Serafina saw among the cloak's victims a woman with long golden brown hair, lying on the ground. She looked weak and confused, but she was alive. Serafina went over to her. She got down on her knees and comforted the woman. As Serafina took her arm and helped her stand, she noticed how lean and muscular the woman was, but she seemed even more disoriented than the others.
"Where are my babies?"
the woman muttered and slurred, hard to understand words. When Nolan came over and covered the shivering woman with his jacket, she pawed it slowly and awkwardly around herself with her open hands, as if her fingers were stiff and didn't bend.
"You're safe now," Serafina assured her. "You're going to be all right."
The woman just stared at the ground, her hair hanging loose around her head. When Serafina slowly brushed back the woman's hair from her face, what she saw startled her. The woman had the loveliest face Serafina had ever seen. She had a perfect pale complexion, high, protruding cheekbones, and long, angled cheeks. But her most striking feature was her amber-yellow eyes. Serafina frowned. She looked at the woman in confusion and disbelief. The woman looked so familiar to her, and yet Serafina was sure she had never seen her before. It was at that moment that she realized that it felt like she was looking into a mirror. Serafina opened her mouth to speak, but her voice was trembling so badly she could barely get the words out.
"Who are you?"
Chapter 28. The woman did not answer the question. She rubbed her eyes and face with the backs of her hands. Then she looked around, glassy-eyed, taking in the forest and the angel's glade, as if she did not understand what she was seeing or how she came to be there. The woman stumbled toward the opening of the lion's den beneath the roots of the willow tree.
"Where are my babies?"
she asked frantically. Seemingly ignorant of the severe danger of entering a lion's den, the woman went to the mouth of the den and looked in. She appeared to think her babies were in there. Serafina felt so sorry for her. The poor creature must have lost her mind in the imprisonment of the cloak. Worried that the lioness would attack the woman, Serafina reached to pull her out of harm's way. But then the woman made a series of sharp, guttural hissing noises, and the lion cubs came trundling out of the den in response to her call. Laughing, the woman dropped down onto her knees and encircled the cubs in her arms as they rubbed their shoulders against her, purring. Serafina cringed, expecting the mountain lion to come charging out of the den at any second. But when she checked the den, there was no sign of the mother lion. Serafina scanned the trees nervously. The woman, still on her knees with the cubs, lifted her hands and looked at her palms, as if they were things of amazement. opening and closing her fingers repeatedly, and she smiled. She rubbed her arms and her head and brushed back her hair like a person who had woken up from a terrible nightmare and had to reassure herself that she was still in one piece. She stood and looked up at the night sky and took a long, deep breath. Then she turned rapidly around, holding Nolan's jacket to her body. She laughed. She tilted her head back and shouted up at the stars, "I'm free!" Still smiling, the woman looked around at her surroundings with a new brightness in her eyes. She looked at the graveyard, the stone angel, and the other victims. Then she looked at Serafina. The woman froze. She stopped smiling. She stopped moving. She just stared at Serafina. Serafina's heart began pounding in her chest, a slow, steady rhythm. "Why are you looking at me like that?" Suddenly, the woman lunged at her with a startling burst of speed. Serafina leapt back to defend herself. But the woman caught her with ease and held her by the shoulders, looking into her face.
"You're her,"
the woman said in astonishment.
"You're really her. I can't believe it. Look at you. I don't understand,"
Serafina stammered, trying to pull away.
"What's your name, child?"
the woman asked.
"Tell me your name." "Serafina,"
she mumbled, staring wide-eyed at the woman.
"Let me look at you,"
the woman said, turning her first one way and then another, as if to take her measure in every way.
"Just look at you. You're so big. How wonderful you are. You're amazing."
Serafina reeled with dizziness as a new wave of confusion swept through her. What in heaven's name was this woman doing?
"Who are you?"
Serafina asked again. The woman paused and looked at her with compassion.
"I'm sorry,"
she said gently.
"I forgot that you don't know me."
"My name is Leandra."
The name meant nothing to Serafina, but the woman's eyes, her voice, her face, everything about her mesmerized her. Serafina felt like sparks of a crackling fire were popping in her mind.
"But who are you?"
Serafina asked again, clenching her fists in frustration.
"You know who I am,"
Leandra said, studying her.
"No, I don't,"
Serafina shouted, stomping her foot.
"I'm your mother, Serafina,"
the woman said softly, reaching out and touching Serafina's face for the first time. Serafina went quiet and still. She frowned in confusion. How could this be possible? She studied the woman's face, trying to make sense of its configuration, trying to understand if she should believe what she was seeing in front of her. Her mouth felt terribly dry. She licked her lips and then clenched them together, breathing through her nose. She tried to steady her breathing as she looked at the woman's hair, her hands, her sinewy body. But it was her eyes more than anything, her yellow eyes, that told her that it was true. This was her mother. Serafina felt her face flush with heat. Suddenly, the image of her mother blurred as the tears welled in her eyes and brimmed over. She released a sigh that turned into a sob, then heaving sobs that she couldn't control. And her mother reached for her and pulled her into her arms.
"Oh, kitten, it's all right,"
her mother said, as her own sobs rolled against Serafina. When Serafina finally spoke, her voice was so weak with emotion that she could only manage one frail and breathless word.
"How?" she asked.